Lord, where are you? You know, come on, quick, I need you, you know.
Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello, I'm Brad Johnson, and welcome to Interface, a weekly examination of Christian perspectives on theology, philosophy, ethics, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church in Costa Mesa, California, and the founder of the Stoa Foundation. We at Interface are very grateful to be on the air, able to offer some different perspectives through the mass media, and we're very honored today to have someone who's been involved with mass media for the last, over 25 years now, Father Michael Manning, a Catholic priest who has been involved in television ministry since 1972. Welcome to Interface.
Thanks, Brad, very much, yeah.
We're just going to dive right in. Adam, would you be so good as to start our conversation today?
I don't even know what I'd want to ask you first. There are so many things that I'm like, oh, okay. I want to know what it's like to be a priest. I want to know what it's like to be a priest in television ministry. I want to know what it's like to be a priest in television ministry on Trinity Broadcast Network. Can we mention that network on this show?
The Trinity Broadcast Network?
The Trinity Broadcast Network.
Sure you can. Okay.
All right, good.
Because I got my program there.
I want to hear your perspectives being in mass media through really the whole development of Christian mass media. You must have seen incredible things. You've ministered all over the country. You've had contacts widely. You're a member of a brotherhood that has missionary ties all over the world.
Yes.
I want to know what you have seen and what you've experienced with the Lord and what it is like from your perspective to serve the Lord in the ways that you have. So pick any of those.
Well, let's start with the Catholic priest. I've wanted to be a priest, I think, since I was in the second grade. I can remember I lived in Arcadia, California, and I used to gather the kids in the neighborhood around the garage door, and I'd celebrate the Eucharist, the Mass, with people and preach to them. They're in the second grade, so watch out. When I was in the sixth grade, the idea had kind of waned a little bit, and then I was 6 foot one by the time I was in the sixth grade, so I was real good at basketball. And I lived in Kentucky at the time, so Kentucky is a big basketball country, so that became a dominant idea in my mind. But then in the sixth grade, a missionary priest came to our school, and so the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade went down to listen to his talk. And I'll never forget that because it was kind of one of those pivotal moments in your life. We can all look back and think of something, you know, that one thing that happened or these things that happened that were so big. And the priest came, I'm sitting there, and he started showing slides. And he showed slides of a missionary riding a horse in Indonesia and a motorcycle in Africa. And I knew that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. But it was at that time that I heard about this community, and it's called Divine Word Missionaries. Jesus, the Word, and the Divine Word, and we try to work, we do work in 55, 60 countries around the world. There are about 6,000 of us, interracial, intercultural, trying to spread the good news, and mainly among the poor and the disenfranchised around the world doing that. So when I was 14, I went to the seminary, and I studied for 14 years in the seminary. Started at high school with a lot of doses of Latin because my courses were taught in Latin in college. Philosophy in Latin, oh boy.
And as if philosophy weren't hard enough as
precisely,
it is.
Precisely.
Oh, man.
But the desire to love the Lord and believing that the Lord called me to this and that the priesthood opens up a real possibility of my being able to tell people about Jesus is just the key to what I want to do. And so my life, I'm coming up on my 30th anniversary. This is crazy. 30th anniversary of being a priest. And it seems so strange because I looked so forward to it from the other end. And here I am now 30 years beyond. It's a life of great joy and great fulfillment. And I find myself very satisfied with this. Satisfied, but at the same time always challenged to try to do more to share the good news with more people. But the priesthood offers me a chance of using a little bit of my theatrical background also to be able to preach and share and use mass media, but also just to be able to tell people about Christ. That's what I want to do, and I can't think of anything more important to do in life.
So many people locate their sense of meaning and fulfillment in families, in the acquisition of goods, in successes per se, as our culture defines them. Maybe this is a little pointed, but do you ever, reflecting back on 30 years, when I'm sure the persons that you knew growing up have pursued and seen to fulfillment many of these other dreams, do you ever have cause to look back and say, oh, I wish I'd had a family?
Sure, of course. When I joined this community, the idea of being a priest for me involves three vows: a vow of poverty, a vow of celibacy, and a vow of obedience. And in these vows, I'm trying to follow Jesus as best I can in his real sense of freedom from material things. You know, the foxes have dens and the birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to put his head. And his challenge to the rich young man, you know, who asked, you know, what do I do to gain heaven? And he said, well, obey the commandments. And the man said, well, I've done that. You know? And he says, well, give up everything you have to the poor and then come follow me. And the man went away sad. But it was the Spirit of Christ to call us, if we hear that call, to give up everything. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have a car that I drive around, because I do have one. I need one. I needed to get here, even though the traffic was crazy. But I need that. I have a computer. I have things. But I'm continually living in a sense of living in community, and that if anybody needs what I have, it's theirs. It's not mine. And I'm continually trying to let go of those things. That's tough. That's tough, because we live in a world where we can easily be seduced by materialism. You know, coming up and saying, if you really want to be happy, you have this car and you have this house and you have these clothes and you have this food and all these things that are going in that. And yet somehow Christ is called to be a sign of contradiction in our world, I believe, a contradiction which says, be careful that you don't get caught up into the world and free yourself from the material things. So you're asking me, was it hard? Yeah, of course it's hard, because I'm continually wanting to hold on to things. But the vow allows me to continually challenge myself to let go. Now, celibacy. Now that's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, celibacy is tough. I find it, especially in times of loneliness and in times of failure, very, very tough. When you're looking for the intimacy of another person to be able to share and to be with, sometimes that isn't there. And that becomes tough, and you struggle with that a great deal. But I'm able to find a community, and I'm able to find that if I can really love the people that I'm with, you know, in the transition, if you will, that I can kind of weather the storm. It's not that, you know, this is not St. Michael of Riverside sitting before you, you know, like that, you know, because I'm a sinner and I fail. But the challenge of the Lord is always there to come and try to be better.
How do you negotiate? What do you do in those times where other dreams compete, where there are times of distress, or because there is a difference between solitude and loneliness?
Yes.
When the loneliness comes in the middle of the solitude, in the middle of a community.
You have to have friends. You have to have people with whom you can relate. You know? And I find that sometimes the frustration of not finding the love that I would perhaps want needs to be corresponded by or balanced by giving love to others. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy, but the more that I find that I don't have love, I need to give it to others. And that means kind of getting out of myself and trying to serve the needs of that person that's in the hospital or the nursing home or maybe the person that calls that just needs to talk and kind of letting myself go in serving that person. That kind of is how I find it in terms of the balance, and also a real sense of prayer, sometimes shouting prayer. Lord, where are you? You know, come on, quick, I need you, you know, that kind of thing. But touching that, and it's tough because we're living in a world of seduction. We're living in a world that's calling us to the struggle with fidelity and responsibility. The movies that we see or the music that we hear offers a very transitional responsibility with regard to sex. It's okay to have sex as long as you're agreeing with it and everything is fine and you're not hurting anybody and all these little cliches that we put together that I have to really fight myself against, you know, and make sure that I'm not doing that, that I'm responsible in my relationships and I'm trying as best I can do that. You know, and it's a growing thing. It's always trying to do that better and better and better in your life. The other vow that I take is the vow of obedience. And that means that in my community, I live in a community, And that obedience means that if my superior, let's say my boss, says, I want you to move here, I might kick and scream a bit and we might argue because I want to make sure that I clarify it. But the bottom line is that I'm willing to say yes to them for the good of the community and be willing to let go of the freedom that is so important in our lives. Oh, gosh. Talk about, when you talk about materialism, then you talk about sensuality, and then you talk about freedom, you talk about some of the key issues that make our lives evolve. And if I can really struggle with letting go of that demand for freedom by submitting myself to the will of another for the good of the community, that death, and oftentimes it kills me. We say, you know, Christ says you got to die to yourself. And I think a lot of times I die to myself when I have to say, okay, you know.
It's like when Paul says, I die daily.
Yes, yeah. And it's that kind of idea of continually willing to kill the selfishness and the hungering for freedom to allow me to make sure that I am a man for others.
Now, that's a very unpopular sort of a concept, in particularly American culture, but Western culture generally.
Sure.
The idea of the autonomy of the self, particularly Protestantism, which emphasizes the individuality of priesthood and kingship and all of these things. I had somebody, and it grieved me, but just to use the phrase to highlight it, I had somebody refer to themselves as a recovering Catholic the other day.
Okay. A recovering Catholic.
And there is this, like you talk about, you saw a priest on a horse, you saw a priest on a motorcycle, and the sense of adventure pulled you into the priesthood. Now, adventure and priesthood are not normally associated concepts. And without the church, you know, outside of the Catholic Church, there is an idea somehow, maybe it's from the authority issues, that the church is draconian. The church is the great oppressor of the West.
And in many ways, that has been.
Hmm.
Oh, sure. Let me just jump in to what you're saying. Pope John Paul has challenged bishops and he's challenged people, Catholics around the world, to examine the times that we have been less than Christian and to seek forgiveness for those times. And you don't have to go too far to find times when this whole thing of control and power and sensuality and money became dominant. And it started to obfuscate the beauty of the gospel message. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think of the times of transition. In around the year 1200, Rome had reached a great sense of power. It not only in terms of spiritual power, but also political power, in which there were armies and whatnot, which, again, when you study church history, you can come at it with a negative bias, but at the same time, you can understand that it was a world in which, because of the threat of many of the outside forces of the barbarians coming in and the weakness of the Roman Empire, someone had to fill the gap. And in many ways, that's what the church did. But, you know, to be good, that's nice, but at the same time, you have to be careful. Well, anyway, around the 12th century, Rome had reached a great sense of opulence and power and hierarchy and distance. And into the scene of a pope by the name of Urban, who was dressed in ermine and all the state and everything that had been the Roman thing, in walked a man by the name of Francis with a gunny sack on and no shoes. He had experienced the Lord in a very powerful way, and he said, I would like to embrace poverty. And what a contrast. And what was so neat was Urban said, yeah. He said, yes, let's do that. And he gave an endorsement to it. And I find that very encouraging. We didn't find the same flexibility when Luther came and said, he ran into the problems of indulgences and the problems of a church that in many ways had gone wrong. The church didn't listen and didn't respond. And so it takes us till now that we start to listen to the challenges that Luther gave, and we're starting to listen to them more effectively.
Hmm.
Did that make any sense?
It does.
Wandering
and,
there?
Yeah. And it brings two things up that I'd love to hear your take on. One, here you have to minister in a society where there is this perception that somehow the church is today what it was in 1300s, and that somehow the church still has this corruption. There's like this lingering ill will left over
Yes.
You know, someone takes a history class in any junior college, mm-hmm. and they hear over and over again about the excesses of the Middle Ages as though somehow that's who the church was today. And do you find that an obstacle to overcome? How do you address that?
Well, the only thing to do is to dialogue about it and talk. You know, let's bring up the instance and not necessarily that I'm going to stand, get down and on my soapbox up and just say to you, no, you're wrong. In many ways, things didn't go the way they should. But at the same time, there are other things that were happening at those times, too, that you don't hear about. And they need to be part of the balance, too, that there were wonderful things. And you can take some of the lives of the saints whose lives just kind of typified a surrender and a dedication to Jesus in a strong way that perhaps don't get the press sometimes in the history books that you might find in other cases. And yet that's important to talk about.
The other thing is, in your opinion, in just purely hypothetically, as a Catholic priest and someone who studies history and someone who is representing the church in a very widespread manner now and focusing on Protestant-Catholic relations, interdenominational relations, if you had the power to roll back the clock and readdress the Reformation, how would you have liked to have seen it turn out?
Well,
and
I think
why?
It should have been much more dialogue. Luther didn't want to leave the church. He didn't. He really didn't. It got into a situation, I think, where church was much more involved in politics. It was much more involved in power. And it needed to listen, and it needed to reform. Similar to Francis coming into the court of the Pope and the Pope saying, okay, let's listen to this and let's allow the balance to come. Whenever we try to find out what's the key to the meaning of life, coming up to the great guru and knocking on the door, the word balance keeps coming back into my vocabulary, that we need to make sure that we're flexible enough to balance and listen and hear and find the good in others, and that we admit our own weaknesses, but then hopefully finding good in others now encourages them to find some good in us. And we can kind of keep going back and forth with the quest for the truth, with the respect for the balance and the respect for the goodness of what's going on in their lives. When you say what I have done with Luther, I think the question is just as valid today. I don't think that the stress on adult indulgences was correct. I think that perhaps the images of some of the saints and some of the relics, you know, that people were getting caught up was wrong. You know, it was out of balance. That's the word, was out of balance, and it didn't go in a good way. Questions about salvation, the concern about spending all of your time working and proving that you could be saved, doesn't deny that you need to do good works, but it also needs to be balanced with the importance of saying, salvation is a gift, and there isn't anything I can do about it. God just loves me, and he's brought me salvation into that. So those kind of things. Am I talking to what you're talking about?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I'm reminded of Paul saying, endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace.
Yeah, yeah.
And, the whole one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of us all. And I can't help but think if this is Scripture, if this is authority, we are commanded to maintain unity. How can we see this realized? How can we see this actualized? If this is a command that we are to shoot for, and yet now we're in a situation where we have so many divergent takes on what it means to be a Christian. We've been being Christians with separated traditions for 2,000 years. How do we live out this mandate from the Lord through the apostle?
I think what you do is you get a radio show and then you invite a Catholic priest to come on the show. Yeah. It is. Yeah. I think it's that. Or you get Paul Crouch with Trinity and he says, Father Manning, come on in and do your show here on our network. It's those kind of things. Or it's inviting people to come to preach in your church or have me having guests on my show that are going to allow that kind of dialogue to happen. I think it's writing. I think it's speaking, and I think it's also very important. I think it's an awful lot of time spent in prayer, making sure that we continually, and I'd urge you to think about that at your Sunday services, to make that a priority of intentions, that we pray that Christians can be united. Because if we're not, gosh, we're just missing the whole boat with regard to evangelization, that if you and I as Christians can't have a sense of respect and honor for each other, why in heaven's name would anybody want to join us or follow Christ? It's the situation that I have with regard to my Jewish brothers and sisters. I was recently giving a talk at the University of Judaism on Catholicism. They wanted me to talk about that. But it just highlights the thing that if Jews can't hear the name of Jesus without feeling anger and aversion, I, as a Christian, bear the responsibility of trying to overcome that evil. And I can't blame them, and now we're getting into history thing, I can't blame them for feeling negative towards Christians, but maybe the burden of their lack of openness to Jesus lies in my life as a Christian, bringing along all the truckload of anti-Semitism that has happened with regard to Christianity against Judaism. There's a responsibility, and we need to work for that. So just that point, whether it's ecumenical or interreligious dialogue, making sure that we're continually sensitive to Christ's desire for unity. And when we talk about interreligious, this might be an interesting thing because I'm very concerned about that dialogue and how I would approach Jews. But that we can start to say that Jesus longs for Jews to love the Father as he did, and that I need to respect that love of the Father that they have and know that Christ is at peace with that and reconciled with that. That's an interesting little thought, but we could get into that a little later.
Maybe we shall, because there are many voices and many forces at work within the Christian community that would say, well, Father Mike, you are one of those perfidious forces in the church who are trying to beat down right doctrine and just turn this fear, you hear the term one world church, and they're sacrificing doctrine for ecumenism. And there is a lot of fear, which it doesn't seem to be characteristic of what Christ would have for us. But there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of suspicion and a lot of anger when someone says, let's be united. And where do you have the line? So this is a two-pronged question. Where do you have the line as far as where you say, this is brother, this is not? And what is inside the church dialogue? What is outside the church dialogue? And how would you address the voices that would say, what you're doing is destructive to the church rather than constructive to the church?
Well, the important thing is realizing the importance of dialogue. Dialogue doesn't mean that you abandon your faith experience, but it does mean that you come with a sense of respect and openness to try to find common ground as best you can with other people. So the Catholic Church now, on a very official basis, has theologians in dialogue, Lutheran Catholic, Evangelical Catholic, Baptist Catholic, even dialogue with Jews and Muslims, in an attempt to get down to some of the nitty-gritty things that we hold in faith and find what kind of common ground do we have. For example, with Greek Orthodox, what does it mean, the importance of the Holy Spirit and Jesus and the Father, and there's differences, and there was a cause of separation. How do we talk about that to be perhaps finding greater clarity?
Father Mike, that brings up a huge issue, and I know that the church has some official positions that you had mentioned, a huge shift in where the church has located itself as far as its borders and its dialogue and its outlook.
Yes.
And I think we are out of time for this show.
That's great.
But
we would
love to dialogue with you about this some more, maybe get on to some other issues about your show and TBN and some of the fun things.
Good deal. So let's hope the traffic is better next week.
All right. Thank you very much. Bradley?
We'll be visiting with Father Michael Manning again next week. It's been a very refreshing time sharing fellowship with you. Thank you for being here, Father Mike.
Thank you.
And
it's an
Adam.
Honor and a great deal. I like this very much.
Thank you very much, Father Mike.
And thank you, Adam, for being here. And we'd like to thank Chris Holowaty, our engineer. We'd like to thank Media City Sound for helping to make Interface possible. And thanks to you for listening.